Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being with us today on WNRN and the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Scratchy headphones, but we're working hard to be with you. And, you know, one of the things I want to do today is we're going to be talking about green energy, the Environmental Protection Agency, and world politics. Now, how does that come all together for a wonderful show? Our guest today, UVA Professor Vivian Thompson, Professor of Environmental Policy and Politics. Good morning. How are you today?
I'm very well. It's such a wonderful, beautiful day outside and happy to be here.
Well, thank you. And you biked in, is that correct?
I did. It's a perfect day for bicycling.
It is the perfect day for bicycling. So, Professor Thompson, your book, Sophisticated Interdependence in Climate Policy, Federalism in United States, Brazil, and Germany.
That's it. That's my book.
In just the last few weeks. So, you know, I'm talking with a friend who asks, oh, what's the show going to be this week? And I tell her the guest and the topic and read your book title. And her reply is, oh, well, I guess that'll be interesting. And it's based on the book title, Sophisticated Interdependence in Climate Policy, Federalism in the United States, Brazil, and Germany. And so I printed this out. I want to read this as the description. I went on Amazon, I think, to get the description of the book title. With the U.S. as the world's most prominent climate change outlaw, international pressure will not impel domestic action. The key to a successful global warming solution lies closer to home. This model is based on her lucrative analysis of economic and political forces affecting climate change policy in selected United States states, as well as on comparative descriptions of programs in Germany and Brazil, two powerful federal democracies whose policies are critical in the global climate change arena. Now, I know that you and I can make this a fascinating, exciting conversation because you and I have already talked a bit about it. But how do you tell somebody, wait a minute, this is not a lecture in my class?
Well, I guess the way I would start off talking about the book is that it was inspired not only by the foot-dragging of the U.S. in the global climate arena, but by the real central importance of the states in regulating air pollution in the United States. And I have a bit of relevant policymaking background here. I actually haven't been just a professor. I was also a policymaker in air pollution at the Environmental Protection Agency. And for 8 years, I was a member and vice chair of the State Air Pollution Control Board in Virginia. And you can't be involved in air pollution policymaking in the United States at the federal or the state level for very long without seeing that in the climate arena, as well as in the air pollution arena generally, the states are really pivotal actors.
And it seems to me, again, for this is about energy. It involves politics. It involves local issues because it involves the state of Virginia. It involves global issues because, while you specifically mentioned Germany and Brazil as a large focus of your book, I couldn't think of a single person who wouldn't go, oh, you know what? That affects me, and I think about that on a regular basis.
Well, I'm really glad to hear you say that. The reception for the book has been really exciting. I've been pleased to have been invited to give talks in a variety of places and also to appear on various radio shows, and actually there's a prospect of a television show around the book as well. But let me just sort of start from square one, and that is why this particular book, why federalism and climate change. So,
all right, you have to remember that we're not all in in your class 301 level. Mm-hmm. So define federalism.
Well, federal democracies like the United States, Brazil, and Germany are nations in which state and often local governments have powers separate and independent from those of the national government. And in the United States, one of the ways that that federal aspect of our system gets reflected in air pollution policy made under the Clean Air Act is that the states are really the ones on the ground implementing air pollution control programs, and they will be in the climate change arena as well. So Brazil and Germany and the United States are the subjects of my book, which focuses on state-federal partnerships here in the U.S., because they're all strong federal democracies and because they're all absolutely critically important in the global climate arena.
So for many people in the United States, the issue of climate change and green energy immediately brings up a diverse and almost divergent conversation, because you either believe or you don't. You agree or you disagree. But as I'm doing my research for the show, you state quite clearly that partisanship is not the cause of different efforts at climate change among states.
Yeah, it's, you know, can sort of come at that issue from several different directions. Actually, the first figure that springs to mind is that in the year 2010, 77% of Virginians said they thought the state government should be doing more to control greenhouse gases. And actually, the sort of passivity of Virginia in the greenhouse gas arena doesn't align well with that strong and broad public support. We've actually had a condition of sort of bipartisan passivity in which Republican and Democratic governors alike in the Commonwealth of Virginia have failed to act in this arena. And conversely, with the states I analyze in my book, I look at 9 states. Some are classified as active in the climate and renewable energy arena, some as surprise states, and some as passive. And partisanship of the governor does not help you predict at all why states have been active or not. You find Republican and Democratic governors alike who have been active and passive. So that drops out pretty quickly as an explanatory factor. And one other thing I'd just like to add, and that is that 67% of Republicans nationwide think we should be moving more toward renewable energy. So of the factors that I looked at in trying to explain why some states are active, why some are passive, partisanship drops out very quickly as a factor that helps us explain those differences.
You mentioned Virginia being a passive state. Why do you say that?
Well, Virginia just hasn't been proactive or active at all.
But
really,
is there a reason behind that?
Oh, yes. Well, let me sort of back up for a second. The setting for the book is the state-federal partnerships that are coming to play with respect to regulating power plant emissions in the United States. And EPA, of course, set forth a proposal on June 2nd to that end. So in anticipation of that state-federal partnership, I wrote the book. And I said, so what we really need to understand in order to help foster strong state-federal partnerships under the Clean Air Act with respect to regulating greenhouse gas emissions is why some states have moved ahead, some have moved ahead, but perhaps with more hesitation, and why some have been passive. So to get to your question, why, according to the analysis I did in my book, what are some of the explanatory factors? Well, my colleague and I, Vicky Arroyo of the Georgetown Climate Center, looked at a wide array of factors. We looked at public salience, for example, statewide polls. What do they tell you about support or lack thereof? We looked at resource space. Is this a fossil fuel state or not? We looked at leadership by the governors. We looked at what's called legislative professionalism. Now, that basically means are the legislators prepared by virtue of expert staff, by virtue of resources at their disposal to gather knowledge, how well prepared are they to deal with a highly technical area? And that's reflected in legislative professionalism, which varies quite a lot across the states. And then there's this thing called political culture, which actually I used a longstanding analysis of a very famous political scientist who categorized all the states with respect to political culture. And sort of bottom line, what you find is that there are pretty clear differences among the active and passive states with respect to political culture, with respect to legislative professionalism, and with respect to fossil fuel base. Those are just three factors I'll start with. To cut to the chase here, in the active states, the state legislators are much more professionalized. They have many more resources at their disposal to deal with this highly complicated area. By contrast, in the passive states, which included Louisiana, South Carolina, and Virginia, the legislatures are less professionalized. They're not well equipped to deal with this arena, and therefore power tends to flow outside of the legislature. With respect to political culture, we find political cultures in the active states that are much more supportive of leaders like governors and legislatures acting in what some call the public good. In the passive states, by contrast, you find political cultures that are more prone to political inertia and lack of activity generally in the policy arena. And then finally, of those three factors I just mentioned, of course, you find that in the passive states, there tends to be much more of a dependence on fossil fuels than you find in the active states. The active states in my book are California, Washington, and New York. There was a sort of a puzzle that my colleague and I ran up against, and that is this issue of public salience. You would expect that on the whole, in states where public salience for action on these issues is high, you would expect activity, and sort of conversely, where public support is low, you would expect a lack of activity. The puzzle for us was that in Virginia, that figure I cited, 77% of Virginians in a statewide poll, just as we were coming out of the Great Recession, were supportive of the state being active in this arena. And how does that mesh? Or it doesn't really mesh with the lack of activity in the legislature and at the governor's level here in Virginia. And when you sort of look at all the factors, I think perhaps political culture, legislative professionalism, sort of low legislative professionalism, and the state's historic reliance on fossil fuels, that those help you account for that lack of alignment between strong public support on the one hand and lack of activity on the other.
11:13 here on the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, WNRN. Our guest today, UVA Professor Vivian Thompson, teaches in both the Environmental Sciences and the Politics Department at the University of Virginia. And her recently released book, Sophisticated Interdependence in Climate Policy, Federalism in the United States, Brazil, and Germany. We're talking about green energy, world politics, or world use of making green energy take place, as well as some of the new regulations from the United States EPA. 11:13, let's do this.
WNRN thanks the following for their support of Independent Music Radio.
T&N Printing, serving Virginia since 1982. In addition to printing and copying, T&N specializes in construction document management, as well as dry mounting, binding, and mail services. T&N offers FSC-certified printing. T&N Printing can be reached at t-nprinting.com.
Whole Foods Market Charlottesville, supporting Service Dogs of Virginia and the Women's Initiative when you bring your reusable bag. Whole Foods picks up the tab for classes every week. On Thursday, you're invited to Wines of the World. You can find Whole Foods Charlottesville's class schedule at wholefoodsmarket.com.
This is your Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you so much for being with us today here on WNRN with our guest, Professor Vivian Thompson. So, Professor, we're talking about sort of green energy and how individual states have been identified passive, active. You talked about how California and New York are, and Washington are making larger steps. Is that the best way to put it?
I think that's a good way of putting it. Although they're not alone. They're just the ones I studied.
And some of this comes about because of the new Environmental Protection Agency regulations. The EPA has come forth, and I think they started June 1st or so?
The proposed regulations came out on June 2nd, yes.
So, and these are being done at the state level. How does something, first of all, I want you to talk about what they are, so the state can do this, but then talk about how one state's work or disregard of what's happening, it's the same, you know, great cloud of air over the entire country. How is this working?
Well, first of all, let me, you had asked before, what helps account for why some states have moved ahead in the renewable energy and climate arena and others haven't? And of course, my analysis was limited to 9 states. But more broadly, there are something like 30 states who have been very active in the renewable energy arena. And part of the, so for example, Texas has been advancing renewable energy for more than a decade now. If Texas were a nation, and I guess some Texans imagine Texas is a nation, if Texas were a nation, it would rank 6th with respect to wind generation capacity in the world. So that's just a small example of the many state programs that have been advanced with respect to renewable energy. And many of those states are just having great luck, not only because they have rich resources, rich renewable resources, but because they find ways of incentivizing.
Let me interrupt real quick.
Yeah.
So Texas could be the 6th largest producer of wind energy,
Texas is, in fact, if you rank the countries of the world, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be confusing.
No, I understand.
Yeah, but if you ranked sort of wind generation and put Texas up there with the countries of the world, Texas would rank 6th.
So they're ranking 6th because on the fact that of what they are already
generating, producing. Yes, exactly. And Texans just see the sort of expression is Texans see green in this. It's not only green energy, but money as well. So before I got into the EPA's proposal, I just wanted to set the stage. Which another reason I wrote the book is that you have this really wide array of inventive and unique programs at the state level for renewable energy and climate. And a huge question has been, how will EPA adapt its proposal to that situation? The states are way out ahead of the national government. So that brings me back to your question about EPA's proposal. Well, in 2007, the Supreme Court of the United States said, well, greenhouse gases harm public health and welfare. And they can be regulated as air pollutants under the Clean Air Act. And this really set the stage for EPA to move ahead. EPA has moved ahead in the last several years to regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act, first for mobile sources, and now large stationary sources are coming. The most recent proposal focuses on existing fossil fuel-fired power plants. And what EPA has said is, using existing technology, practical, cost-effective technology, we can accomplish a 30% reduction in carbon dioxide emissions from power plants, and that's in 2030 relative to 2005. We can accomplish a really important reduction in carbon dioxide emissions by applying practical, cost-effective technologies. And what EPA is doing under this particular part of the Clean Air Act, which again calls for the states really to take the lead, EPA has proposed carbon dioxide limits. They take the form of rates, carbon dioxide emission rates, that are averaged across every state. So EPA published, and of course there's a lot of sort of legal and policy and technical and economic background included in this 650-page proposal, but when you go, I guess, about 350 pages in, there's a table that lo and behold gives interim targets for each state, and those interim targets apply in between 2020 and 2029. And then there's a final target for the year 2030. Now, it's important to understand that no individual utility has to meet that rate. It's a statewide average. Both the interim goal and the final goal are statewide averages. And EPA came up with these proposed emission rates by looking at what is achievable. For example, how much more efficient in terms of their heat, what's called heat rate, how much more efficient can existing power plants be? What is the potential for renewable energy? And EPA includes nuclear in that category. What is the potential for actually reducing, giving people incentives to reduce the amount of electricity they use? And combining these various sort of practical, known, cost-effective technologies, EPA looked at each different state, each state's particular circumstances, and has proposed an interim and a final emission rate that each state will have to meet. And the states have an enormous array of possible ways of meeting these rates. And to sort of link back to my book, one of the conclusions I drew from my 9-state analysis is, given the enormous differences in factors like legislative professionalism, political culture, natural resource base, public salience, leadership by governors, you really need to craft a program under the Clean Air Act that allows flexibility for those different circumstances, but also says, look, there are a lot of cost-effective technologies, yet let's use them. So those are sort of how the primary elements of the EPA proposal and some of the conclusions of my book really mesh pretty well.
This sounds as the 1122 here on the wake-up call, talking about green energy, new EPA regulations, and world methods for green energy with Professor Vivian Thompson. So you talk about how each state will be asked to reduce its output in its own individual way.
That is correct.
And so why did it take us 50 years to come up with the concept that reducing everyone individually helps overall, rather than what seems to have been, again, not my specialty here, to apply one country regulations that everyone must meet?
Well, you know, actually, the very first page of the Clean Air Act, and when we say the Clean Air Act, we really sort of mean the 1970 Clean Air Act and subsequent amendments to it. If you look at the very first page, it says the states are on the front lines. The states implement all of these programs under the Clean Air Act. So, and that's quite typical of our major national environmental laws. Come back to that a question you had at the beginning. We're a federal nation, and that strong reliance, that strong base of power in the states is reflected in countless, I don't want to say every, but countless programs and the laws that EPA administers. And under the Clean Air Act, the states, each state, in essence, implements Clean Air Act programs at the state level. For existing sources, it has been the longtime practice of EPA to defer to the states for their decisions about how they want to regulate existing sources. It's a little bit of a different, for new sources, but still there's a really integral part for the states with regulating new sources as well as existing sources. So actually, this is a continuation of a pattern of power sharing between the states and the national government that we've had really since the 1970 Clean Air Act.
Has this been received on a more positive manner than other regulations have in the past?
Well, you know, there are so many different voices out there. I'm sure that there will be lots of push and pull in different directions with respect to this newest EPA proposal.
That is a very kind way to put that.
Yeah. Well, I was on the State Air Pollution Control Board for 8 years, so yes, that is a kind way of putting some of the pressures I experienced. But, you know, just to take an example of how the Clean Air Act, how I felt the Clean Air Act's reach when I was on the State Air Pollution Control Board, almost every decision we took had to do with the Clean Air Act. It flowed from the Clean Air Act, whether it had to do with regulating sulfur dioxide emissions from a coal-fired power plant in Alexandria, or setting new source permit limits for Dominion's new facility in Wise at the southwest part of the state. We were implementing the Clean Air Act at the state level, and that's what state regulators feel. Some states like California, of course, have their own laws added on top of the Clean Air Act, but the Clean Air Act really, from page one, is about state-federal partnerships.
But that doesn't mean that, and I'll pick on states that I know nothing about, Kentucky. It doesn't mean that Kentucky, that its governor and its legislative group says, okay, we can work on that. We can do that because you have identified our individual needs and not asked us to do the same thing that California is doing.
Well, 50 different states, 50 different reactions. Some states may say, no problem, we have existing programs in place. Our renewable energy programs will help meet EPA's suggested proposed limits. So you're going to get the spectrum of reactions. And some states will choose to balk. They'll choose to sue EPA. Of course, we're not at that stage yet because EPA is only in the proposal stage. And for the next year, EPA will be taking comments. But, you know, EPA is working with a part of the Clean Air Act that, again, really sets limits based on what's available and what's affordable by way of technology. It's not really pushing any technological limits.
Again, our professor, Vivian Thompson, here is our guest today. Her book, Sophisticated Interdependence in Climate Policy. We're talking about a variety of things with green energy, the recent EPA regulations from June 2nd. So let's step into, part two is how I think of your book, because it's the section after the colon. Federalism in United States, Brazil, and Germany. So we'll take the conversation to a grander level.
Okay.
We talk about the United States is not known very well worldwide for doing much about its pollution.
Yes, I call us the world's most prominent climate change outlaw.
So what rules are we breaking?
Well, under a succession of presidents, again, Republican and Democratic alike, we have been the most prominent holdout from signing the Kyoto Protocol, which is the worldwide treaty to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, if we didn't sign it, how are we breaking it?
Well, the rest of the world looks at us as an outlaw for having not signed that treaty, to be perfectly honest. And I was a Fulbright professor in Denmark for a year in 2001 to 2002. And, of course, President Clinton did not, he signed the protocol, but he did not take it to the Senate for ratification. President George W. Bush said he was not interested in implementing the protocol and, in fact, tried to reverse the signature of the U.S. on the protocol. But when I was in Denmark, the U.S.'s really steadfast refusal to join in the global problem, in solving the global problem that the U.S. has contributed significantly to, our intransigence there, it spills over into other arenas. Well, the U.S. isn't going to be a good partner there, and so, well, maybe we won't be a good partner over here with the U.S. The U.S. has been regarded as a leader in the environmental arena, and we really lost that leadership with our refusal to sign the protocol and implement greenhouse gas reductions here. But that is changing. It changed. The pivotal moment really was that 2007 Supreme Court decision, which said, the Supreme Court of the United States said, look, we've looked at the evidence, and the evidence is that greenhouse gases are harming public health and welfare. And the scientific evidence has only gotten more certain since that time.
So your book title and a lot of the the material involved, because you work with, there's, I don't know if two other authors is correct, but you have two other fellow scientists, fellow professors, who, someone representing Germany and another representing Brazil in the conversation about this, correct?
Well, actually, I take full responsibility for the book. I wish I could pass the responsibility on to others, but it's completely written by me. The state analysis here was done with my colleague in Washington. But I visited Brazil several times. I've worked with colleagues in Brazil and Germany in writing the book. I definitely depend on my German colleagues for information and help, yes.
And so why those two countries? I mean, as someone who's almost nearly completely uninformed on the topic, Brazil, okay, that works well with Brazil because they have the rainforest, and you don't have to do anything except watch some bad TV shows to know that the rainforest is being damaged by climate change. Germany. I don't know what Germany has to do with green energy and climate change. So please explain why those two countries were put with the U.S. in this book.
Well, Brazil and Germany are the two leading federal democracies. Again, those kinds of situations in which the state and national governments have independent, often overlapping powers, but in which there's a subnational set of governments that are very important. Brazil and Germany are the two most important federal democracies after the United States, and also they speak loudly in the climate arena. So, since you asked about Germany, let's start with Germany, and I'm sure we'll circle back to Brazil. In the Kyoto Protocol, which I mentioned earlier, that international treaty to reduce climate emissions, the European Union was an early signatory. And the European Union agreed to a goal of reducing its emissions by 2012 collectively. And Germany's goal was responsible for approximately 75% of that emissions goal. So Germany, not only a high emitter, but also has had a very aggressive goal in terms of greenhouse gas emissions that is absolutely central to the European Union's goal, which they overshot, by the way. The European Union actually did better than the reduction goal that they had set for 2012. And that's really pivots around Germany's aggressive renewable energy and climate change programs. And they extend back to 1990. And they're kind of remarkable in a couple of ways. First of all, there is agreement across parties in Germany about the need to move toward renewable energy and to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And that cross-party agreement extends back to the 1990s. For example, Chancellor Angela Merkel is of the Christian Democratic Union party, a fairly conservative party, and she has been outspoken in this arena for 20 years. She tried to get President Bush to reconsider his position on the Kyoto Protocol. So the Germans have just really, they've made astounding progress. Part of what they did was to close down a lot of old, very inefficient, very high-polluting industries in the former Eastern Bloc when Germany reunified. That is what we call the wall fall effect in terms of pollution reductions. They closed a lot of those industries, and that got them about halfway toward their overall greenhouse gas emission goal. But they've also been very aggressive in promoting renewable energy and greenhouse gas emission reductions, to the point that in the latest figures, it's roughly a 25% reduction in greenhouse gases in Germany relative to 1990. And to sort of give a point of comparison, in the between 1990 and 2010, greenhouse gas emissions per capita, per person in Germany, went down by 26%, while GDP per capita increased by 36%. And conversely, in the United States, our greenhouse gas emissions per capita in that same 20 years decreased by 2%, but our GDP per capita increased by a lower amount than in Germany, 31%.
So why is one part of the world pro? Because there, I mean, we're talking about democratic societies, democratic mm-hmm. cultures. Mm-hmm. Why is the European Union, a large section of the world, pro for this, and the United States con, or at least not do passive? I'm not sure where they would fall into this discussion.
Well, of course, the European Union is sort of a large federation, a large collection of different nations.
Understood.
And so there are differences among all those
but
nations.
But they come together
they
as
did.
A group to say, yes, this is important, and do this. And the United mm-hmm. States has either said it's not important, or at least said, well, yeah, but we don't want to do it that way.
Well, I guess what I would prefer to stress at this point is that the U.S. has come late to the realization of its responsibility and obligation, but the U.S. is now at the table, especially with this most recent proposal. And you and I were talking earlier about China and the fact that, of course, now China's overall greenhouse gas emissions exceed those of the United States. And people rightly say, well, we kind of get China on board in order for us all to solve this problem effectively. And that's true. But if you look at the best estimates with respect to who has contributed the most to the greenhouse gases that are up there now, one very credible estimate shows that the U.S. has contributed about 30% between 1850 and 2000, 30% of the greenhouse gases globally that have been emitted to the atmosphere, and China 7% in that same interval. And so it's sort of as if, you know, you had a collective living room, the global commons, right? And one member of the household had been throwing trash in there for 150 years,
I'm assuming that's the United States.
That's the United States. And then China comes in and starts throwing some trash in. You know, we were the ones who were there first. We should clean up first. And so I guess what I would like to stress is we're there, we're late, and now we have the world's attention.
11:38 here on the Wake Up Call with our guest, Professor Vivian Thompson, who apparently she and I live in a world where the United States is throwing some trash in the living room, and we're discussing about how to clean this up. We'll be right back.
Support today for WNRN comes from
Price Hyundai on 29 North. From Hyundai, it's the new Veloster, 38 miles per gallon highway, standard BlueLink telematics with hands-free texting. The new Veloster, new thinking for the next generation of drivers. You can find out more at jimpricehyundai.com.
Locally owned Animal Medical Center, a full-service animal hospital specializing in diagnostic and treatment options for your four-legged friends with over 20 years of experience. Animal Medical Center is off Route 250 East in the Pantop Shopping Center next to Mount Kim Martial Arts. Online at sevilleshop.com/pantops.
Hi, I'm Paul Fleischer from the Richmond Peace Education Center. On Sunday, June 22nd, we present folk singer John McCutcheon at the Maggie Walker Governor's School Auditorium at 1000 North Lombardy Street. McCutcheon will include a tribute to Pete Seeger while also drawing on his vast catalog of more than 30 albums. All proceeds from this concert benefit the Richmond Peace Education Center, which has been a leading voice for nonviolence in the Richmond community for more than three decades. Through programs on conflict resolution and violence prevention, racial reconciliation, and global issues, the center is making a difference in the region. For more details and tickets, rpec.org. I'm Paul Fleischer, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection@WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you so much for being with us today here on WNRN and Richmond's 103.1. Again, our guest, Professor Vivian Thompson from UVA's Environmental and Political Department. She teaches environmental policy and politics over at UVA. Her book, Sophisticated Interdependence in Climate Policy, Federalism in United States, Brazil, and Germany. Professor, there's no way we can get through all the material in this book. Can people purchase it outside of the UVA bookstore?
Yes, absolutely. It's available in many online spots. Amazon springs to mind first. Only $19 on your Kindle and around $30 for a paperback edition. So I'm certainly hoping that many people will be intrigued by our discussion today and will just run right out and buy it.
There you go. So you mentioned the Kyoto Protocol and United States being an outlaw of some sorts. When was the protocol signed? 1990-something?
1997.
So in that time, have the other states, the other countries who've signed it, remained active in living up to the standards? And if there has been a law or two, how are conflicts resolved?
Good question. Certainly, the European Union overshot its goal collectively, and the European Union was sort of the other major player when it came to nations that were required to reduce their emissions under the Kyoto Protocol. So a big question is, where do we go from here? The protocols sort of were looking at next steps after the initial, what they call the initial commitment period, one of those nice jargon terms. The initial commitment period for the protocol ended in 2012. And there will be more climate discussions over the next few years, and the real hope is that the United States, now that sort of reclaimed a bit of its leadership in this arena, can help with a constructive sort of second phase of a global agreement.
So you've mentioned a couple times now that the United States is improving in what we're doing globally. You just said that we've reclaimed some of our leadership in this topic. Other than Texas, using wind turbines, it still seems to me, again, very lost in a lot of this conversation, is what have we done to improve in comparison to the rest of the world?
Well, of course, there are new regulations for fuel efficiency and carbon dioxide emissions from vehicles. Those were enacted in a couple of very major regulations in the last several years. So we've done that. And of course, transportation emissions are a big part of our greenhouse gas profile here in the United States. But what the EPA has to build on here with this recent proposal is 30 states at least. I haven't counted them all up, but many of the states have proceeded for the past 10 years or so with their own renewable energy and greenhouse gas or greenhouse gas programs. So there's this really strong foundation of activity that varies from one state to the next, but a really strong foundation at the state level for EPA to build on. So when I think about activity in the U.S., it's at the subnational level. Also the mobile source regulations, the vehicle regulations that the Obama administration has implemented as well.
Now, in some countries, in Germany, I believe we didn't talk about it, but somewhere in your work, I found that citizens are asked to install solar panels that they can then sell back power to the grid for generous prices.
Yes, and actually they're not asked to install solar panels. You see them everywhere in Germany. You mentioned that I rode my bicycle in this morning. There are bicycle paths all over Germany. One of my favorite things to do there is to rent a bicycle and ride. And you go out in the countryside, you see solar panels on many homes. And it's not because they're required. It's because the incentives are really great. And what the Germans did for renewable energy is to, well, in the case of solar panels, for example, allow citizens to have the confidence that if they install these panels, that they will make their money back or even more, and they'll be able to sell excess electricity back to the grid at guaranteed rates. Now, the Germans are very clever in a number of ways about this. I mean, first of all, now Germans associate climate change and renewable energy to a great extent with making money. And that's also the case here in the United States, in places like Texas, where there are incentives to install wind power, in Iowa, in lots of states, they sort of jumped on board with this connection of incentives and renewable energy. But Germans now associate the drive to renewable energy and energy security for them with being able to contribute productively to reducing greenhouse gas emissions and also to make their money back. So it's not a requirement by any means. It's an incentive-based program. And what happens over time is that the amount that people get reimbursed goes down. So if you were to do a contract now, I believe this is the case. They're very detailed, but I believe that you would get less than somebody who, for example, installed cells 5 or 10 years ago. The idea is the technology gets better, it gets cheaper. Therefore, over time, you reduce the amount that people are guaranteed by way of a return.
Is that proposition led by the German government? And if so, what do the German utility companies think about that?
Well, none of these questions are without controversy, and I think you would depend on which German utility.
Well, but just think about the reason for the question comes from the fact that it seems as though that utilities in the United States have such a large political and financial clout, and they are so ingrained in the political system that we may or may not ever get to that point of doing that. So the question is, does the German government have a big enough hammer to make that happen? Or are the utilities for all I know, the utilities are completely socially run.
Oh, no, they're not socially run in Germany. I wish I could speak to exactly how the partnership between the utilities and the federal government has worked over the years. Certainly, there have been a number of controversies, but the German government has been able to move ahead, again, in large part because of this cross-party agreement, because support of ordinary German citizens, and because Germans really are dedicated to diversifying their energy base. One of the important lessons I think that we can get from the way the Germans have implemented their programs is to, look very carefully at finding the most cost-effective way of doing this. There has been, some sense that perhaps the cost of these renewable energy systems has fallen unduly on residential customers in Germany, and that big industrial customers have not borne their fair share. So there are questions of equity, and that's certainly one of the learning curves for us when we look at Germany, but also these kinds of incentives are being put in place here at the state level, and so there is a lot of experience for us to use here in developing the response to the EPA proposal.
UVA professor Vivian Thompson here with us today as we talk about green energy, world politics. I don't know if politics is the right word, but talking about how this works globally. So Germany, but you also have Brazil in your title of your book. And I see that Brazil, 80% of Brazil's electricity comes from hydropower plants.
Yes. Brazil is almost energy independent, which is
something we can just dream about
here in the United States. And their energy independence has historically come from that reliance on hydropower, but also sugarcane ethanol. And sugarcane ethanol, of course, thrives in a tropical environment. So
that's a part of their ethanol in their cars?
Yes, and sugarcane ethanol, if manufactured properly and if the agricultural practices are managed properly, is much more environmentally friendly than corn ethanol. So, but it's not so much, you know, what we learn from the Brazilians is, well, we should switch to sugarcane because it's a tropical plant. But if you look at the way the government subsidized at first to sort of give a push to the growing and manufacturing of sugarcane ethanol and then reduce the subsidies over time, that's a very interesting lesson. Give a little bit of a boost at first, and then the last time I was informed by my Brazilian colleagues, all of those subsidies have now been taken away. You know, Brazil is, you know, especially the World Cup, all eyes are on Brazil now. Such a fascinating place in which there are a lot of parallels with the United States. Land areas about the same. We're both leaders in producing soybeans and cattle, for example. Regionalism is really strong in Brazil. If you look at a map of Brazil, actually many maps of Brazil show these distinctive regions that Brazilians just take for granted. It's like for us, the South, the North, the Midwest. And so there's very distinctive sort of regions like the United States that have their own stamps with respect to economy, with respect to culture, with respect to greenhouse gas problems. For example, the Amazon is in the northern part of the country. And of course, one of the reasons that Brazil is so key in the global climate arena is that the Amazon is huge. And when there's deforestation, a lot of deforestation in the Amazon, that really contributes heavily to greenhouse gas emissions. Now, in the past decade, the Brazilians have just had extraordinary success with reducing deforestation and therefore with reversing the greenhouse gas emissions from deforestation of the Amazon. Can they continue that? That's a legitimate question, but that success is pretty extraordinary. Still, what that regionalism means is that the greenhouse gas problems of the Amazon are in the north, but in the south, where you have more industrial states and more of the wealth of the country, the emissions there are more oriented around energy and manufacturing. So again, that idea of distinctive solutions for distinctive regions, that's something that you look at Brazil and the United States, and that's a very strong parallel. And the last thing that I'll add with respect to something that really hit me when I was studying Brazil and its way of approaching greenhouse gas emissions and the sort of profile that Brazil has to deal with, and that is the issue of minority communities. Like the United States, Brazil has a very mixed population. Brazil was the last country in the world to eliminate slavery, even after the United States. And Brazil faces some of the same challenges we do here when it comes to climate change, and that is fully incorporating minority and vulnerable communities into the conversation and making sure that they feel a part of, for example, how the states under EPA's proposal move ahead.
Again, our guest, Professor Vivian Thompson, as we talk about green energy. I just want to remind you that there are many ways to stay connected to WNRN. There are free iPhone and Android apps created by Willow Tree Apps, available at iTunes or Google Play. We also recommend TuneIn for your smartphone to listen to WNRN anywhere. And we stream 24/7 at WNRN.org. Remember, no matter where you go, you can listen to WNRN. Professor, so we're talking about Brazil and the great work that's being done there, the lessons that are being taught. Is the United States a little too proud?
Proud of?
Proud to listen to another country like Brazil?
Of course, the place that I land in my book has to do with this term I call sophisticated interdependence. And part of that, a key part of what I see as sophisticated interdependence, is the U.S.'s recognition that, especially in the climate arena, we are part of a global commons. What we do matters, what we don't do matters, and hoping that we will really reach out to our partners, whether they're in the European or in Brazil or other parts of the world, and collaborate with respect to emissions mitigation and really tackling the problems of global climate change. So I'm hoping that this sort of new energy that's being put behind climate change program at the national level will translate into an openness in the international arena to work with our partners in countries like Brazil and Germany.
Just a few minutes left on the conversation. I want to go back to the new EPA regulations.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody always wants to know how that affects us locally.
Mm-hmm.
We have Dominion Power.
Mm-hmm.
We have Appalachian Power.
Mm-hmm.
There's a new, you mentioned that nuclear power is considered a sustainable.
Well, it's sort of wrapped into a cost-effective way to reduce CO2 emissions, let's put it that way.
Okay. And Dominion has had discussion about building a third reactor.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the June 2nd conversation will affect Dominion Power's decision?
Well, that's a very long permitting process, and so I'm there.
You
will
have
be
4 minutes.
Oh, okay. Well, I won't talk about the permitting process then. We will not go in that direction.
Is it longer than that?
Let me just see if I can stand back and talk about some of the impacts that EPA projects for its rule. And of course, some of these are national averages, but they give you a sense for what might happen in Virginia with respect to these rules. Now, you have to recognize that in addition to greenhouse gas reductions, fossil fuel facilities that are incorporated into these rules will also reduce other pollutants like sulfur dioxide and oxides of nitrogen. And the net social benefits, what we mean by that is the improvements in health and public welfare that result from this rule, not only as a result of greenhouse gas emissions, but also reductions in these other air pollutants, those are in the tens of billions. The net benefits, that is, subtracting out the costs, the net benefits per year in 2030 are approximately $50 to $80 billion worth of net social benefits, that is, after the costs. And many of the social benefits, many of the health improvements that will result as from these rules are unquantified. So when you think about these rules, you think not only about greenhouse gas reductions, but also improvement in smog and particulate matter levels.
Right. Real quick, when you say net social benefits, are you mm-hmm. talking about trips to the hospital as
yes.
well as just removing
exactly.
Smog from
asthma
the air?
Attacks, for example, asthma attacks, and actually reductions in mortality because people do die because of exposure to air pollution. So the benefits from this rule in terms of reduction, improvement in public health and welfare are not just related to greenhouse gases. They're also related to reducing those more common sort of traditional air pollutants like soot and smog. For example, EPA estimates that the rule that is just proposed would prevent something like 2,700 to 6,600 premature deaths. So you have to think expansively with respect to the public health and welfare benefits of the rule. Now, in terms of the sort of cost side, in 2030, when the final rule goes into effect, EPA projects that electricity bills will be 8% lower than they would have been without the rule. And that's because of the improvements, finding ways to cut wasted energy, finding ways to reduce demand for energy.
We've got seconds left. Do you really believe that? Because businesses just make profit wherever they can. If they save money, they don't give it back. They just keep it.
But if they're given incentives to reduce demand, they do that. It's happened in California
for decades.
All right.
I'll give you that one. All right. One more time, because we're out of time, even though we could keep going with other questions and comments. Your book, Sophisticated Interdependence in Climate Policy, Federalism in United States, Brazil, and Germany, can be found
on Amazon. Any of your could be ordered from any of your favorite bookstores.
You can go over to the University of Virginia bookstore.
Absolutely.
At the top of the parking lot.
See if it's a Barnes and Noble. If not, tell them to get it. They'll get it quickly, I'm sure.
All right. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
All right. Next week, Sean Tubbs will be here. We'll be talking about the future of Route 29. Les Timms-Perdue up next.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Brandon Wong and Max Cecilia Struther. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.